There are plenty of movies about a future in which human beings are no longer in command of the Earth. Think the Matrix series or the Terminator series. Science fiction, sure, but science fiction usually begins with at least a grain of truth, or at least a concern about real-world technology. We'll talk about that real world in this hour with Wendell Wallach. He is the author of A Dangerous Master, How to Keep Technology from Slipping Beyond Our Control. Wendell Wallach works out of Yale University in the Interdisciplinary Center for Bioethics. He's a scholar, ethicist, and consultant there, and leader of the Technology and Ethics Study Group, T&E. Wendell is the co-author of an earlier book, Moral Machines, Teaching Robots Right from Wrong. So he's been down this pathway, at least in part, before. Wendell Wallach, join us. Thanks for joining us on the Jefferson Exchange.
Thank you ever so much, Jeff. Those of us on the East Coast are feeling for those of you on the West with such hot weather.
Well, that's okay. We usually feel for you with the heat and the humidity combined, so we each get our crosses to bear. Science fiction fans may, in fact, love this book. You have chapter titles referring to The Terminator and The Dune and others.
Yep, I certainly do. The book, though, tries to cover a broad array of technologies to get behind the headlines and make sure that readers have an understanding of the many emerging technologies, their benefits, their risks, the societal impact, and how we can address the harms or at least mitigate the possibility of there being too many things going wrong.
Yeah, I must say you walk a pretty good line here because it could be scary to a lot of people. I mean, there are enough things that people are concerned about that exist already in today's world, but you're pretty clear on identifying what some of the possibilities are, some of the things that have happened already, and what the concerns are. You do say the book came out of a conversation along those lines with a friend in 2011. What was that friend disturbed about?
Well, the friend just felt that everything was inevitable, there was nothing we could do, and that basically it was downhill for humans in general from here.
Yikes.
And that in fact, we might even be inventing the human species as we know it out of existence. But that gets more toward, what shall I say, the science fiction fringes than the realities of what we're dealing with, at least over the next 10 or 20 years.
So fair to say that A Dangerous Master is about identifying those concerns and trying to explain that, yes, there is some... There's cause for concern, but perhaps not as great as some people might think?
I would say yes, but there are some of the concerns that cause more. There's some of the issues that cause more concern, and there's some that might cause less. So I'm trying to get us out of both the hype and the fear.
All right. The very first example you cite is the Large Hadron Collider in Switzerland.
Right.
And the concerns that was going to create a black hole. Are you worried about black holes?
I'm not worried about black holes. I think that may have been an incorrect fear being raised. But interestingly enough, there's another similar fear called strangelets that's being raised by another collider that's being updated in Brookhaven, New York right now. And strangely enough, there's probably a greater likelihood of a strangelet being created than a black hole. At least that's what the cosmologists and physicists who understand these things are telling me.
Well, the term itself is intriguing. What is a strangelet?
Well, if I really understood, I would probably be a nuclear physicist or something. But a strangelet seems to be a kind of physical phenomena. They were created soon after the Big Bang. And if one should occur, it would be an existential risk. It would destroy humanity.
Is this the one that might collapse the Earth down to like a 120-mile sphere or something along those lines?
That's exactly what that is. And Martin Rees, a cosmologist at Cambridge University, is one of the people who is most concerned about strangelets.
So are there ways to test the theories about strangelets, or in the case of the Large Hadron Collider, about the creation of black holes, however temporary, without actually turning them on? I mean, are there computer models sufficient to anticipate all the things that might happen?
Well, there are better computer models, shall we say, are mathematical models in physics, and there are in other fields of research that get so entangled with human activity, which is highly unpredictable. But in the area of physics, presuming we understand all the physical laws entailed, the scientists can give a fairly good prediction of what to anticipate. The question is, how good is that prediction? They might put it in terms of, let's say, 99.44% accurate, but that doesn't give much solace to those of us who could be the recipients if something truly did go wrong. But I think at least in the case of the Large Hadron Collider, they did their work once pressed to try to be sure that a tiny black hole that would suck up the Earth would not occur.
So that brings us to big ethical question number one. I mean, if we're talking about testing a theory and there's even the tiniest chance of some large-scale destruction like that, should that stop the project?
Well, in some cases, it should. I mean, who has the right to decide that even if there is an infinitesimal chance that the world could, that humanity could be eradicated, that experiment should proceed forward? The difficulty is deciding when that is the case and when it isn't the case. So, for example, we've always been under threat that an asteroid or a comet could destroy the planet. But in the way in which a comet affected the planet and eradicated dinosaurs. So the question is, how much energy should we put defending off such a possibility when it may only occur once every, 100,000 or million years?
But once is certainly enough, as was for the dinosaurs. We'll come back and talk more about the ethical questions involved with technology and science. A Dangerous Master is Wendell Wallach's book. We'll come back and talk with Wendell and take your phone calls and emails when we return to The Exchange in a minute 10. This is the Jefferson Exchange on the News and Information Service of Jefferson Public Radio. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. Our guest today is the ethicist Wendell Wallach from Yale University. We're talking about the future in terms that involve taking off the 3D glasses from the Matrix movies and actually getting a clear-eyed look at the potential dangers of the technology we create. Wendell Wallach's book is A Dangerous Master, How to Keep Technology from Slipping Beyond Our Control. You can join us on the Jefferson Exchange at 800-838-3760, anywhere in the listening area, by email jx@jeffnet.org. When we talk about, Wendell, whether scientists should not do something because of even a tiny chance of a risk of something like a black hole or a strangelet that could collapse the Earth into a dead, dense ball, I kept hearing the voice of Dick Cheney in my head, of all people, because of the way he would talk about if we think there's any chance of a threat from abroad, we have to act upon it militarily. So this is sort of the inverse of that, in the sense that if we think something could happen, we should not be taking steps. But when you were talking about this in relation to comets and asteroids, what are some of the thoughts about what we should or should not be doing there?
Well, a comet or asteroid that could eliminate humanity, they perhaps only occur once every 100 million years. But the difficulty is, this is a probability thing. So it could actually happen, next month or next year. So you don't eliminate the chance. So how much energy, how much money should we be putting in to ward off a threat like that? And this is being taken seriously by scientists, and some money has gone into, if not fend off the big humanity killers, the smaller asteroids at this stage of the game. But that brings us back to other technologies in which it's much harder to predict the likelihood, and we're dealing with things like new biotechnologies, some of which could be pathogenic or could alter the environment in negative ways, even though they have countless benefits, or robots that certainly have untold benefits, but there has been recently expressed concern about a kind of Terminator scenario where they are smarter than us and, in fact, their actions eliminate us from future history. So the question is, how much care should we take in fending those off? Do we fall into what is sometimes called a precautionary principle, where you don't go ahead with anything until it has been proven that it's safe, or at least the proof that it's safe lies with the scientists who want to implement that new technology? Or, as is in the United States' cases, do we go ahead with technologies largely because they are perceived to be productive and the chance that they could be harmful lies with those who criticize them to prove that?
Well, we do seem, particularly in the United States, to develop technology first and the ethics of using new gadgets later. There are other ways, I would presume, but it seems like it often comes down, given our system, to, well, gee, can we make money at this? And then can we figure out later how we clean up after this?
And unfortunately, that's the case. More often than not, we get to a situation where we do clean up afterwards. It's only when a tragedy occurs that we fully put our heads to how to mitigate that occurring again. But then again, you're always dealing with yesterday's tragedies. You're seldom dealing with tomorrow's possibilities. So what many of us are trying to propose is what is sometimes called a middle ground, where you're more effectively monitoring what is likely to occur, and you try and address it before the tragedies occur.
All right. So you've taken an assessment of the risks before you plunge in.
Yeah, this is sometimes called anticipatory ethics or anticipatory governance.
In general, do you have a sense of whether we are too deferential to scientists, whether too often we would say, well, okay, you know, they're just going to do some experiments with particle accelerators versus the people who say, no, don't trust them. They could collapse the Earth. I mean, we're too deferential. We're not deferential enough. It certainly gets muddled with politics when you get all the presidential candidates saying, well, I'm not a scientist, therefore I don't understand climate change.
Right. I think that's a very difficult question. I think it has a lot to do with which technologies we're talking about. So the problems with climate change, I think, have been pretty clear to everyone, and we're really caught up in the politics of what you would do if that's occurring. And perhaps climate change denial is more about staving off some of the political ramifications of that than whether climate change really exists. I think there are certainly situations where we're so anxious to get the productivity gains out of science or out of new technology. I'll use as an example, perhaps that we'll get back to the introduction of drones in domestic airspace. But what has heartened me, and particularly over the last 6 months, have been responsible scientists coming forward and saying that we need to give much more attention to the downsides of artificial intelligence and a new form of gene editing known as CRISPR. And what's thrilling is that these are often the very same scientists who created these new technologies.
Really? So they're the ones who then later on say, wait a second, this is not how this should be used.
Well, I think the difficulty is they're creating these technologies because they do think that the benefits can far outweigh the risks. But they do want us to attend to the risks, and in some cases they're even coming up with scientific, not even governance or oversight methods for trying to address the risks. But even those scientific methods don't mean much unless all scientists implement them.
Wendell Wallach is our guest on the Jefferson Exchange. His book is A Dangerous Master, How to Keep Technology from Slipping Beyond Our Control. You mentioned drones briefly. Let's come in a little more directly, because there's an example you give in the book of a drone that just didn't do what it was supposed to do. What was the story there?
Which example are you referring to?
It's the military drone that ended up slipping off the end of the runway.
Oh, right. Sure. Well, that's a fascinating case, and it's a case about the difficulty of really managing any kind of complex system. So that was a case where you were coordinating the drone operators with the drone, and the drone had actually already landed on the runway, but there was confusion between the operators and, let's say, the software in the drone, and therefore there were competing commands coming to that software. It created a confusion. The drone ran off the runway, and its nose collapsed, and it caused more than $1 million in damages.
But what was learned from that that could potentially have been used later on or could
well,
be?
Well, this is the question, is what was learned for that and whether what was learned from that is the right lessons, because this kind of situation comes up over and over again. So what most people think gets learned from that is that we should invest more autonomy into the system itself and not depend upon humans as much. So the blame goes to the human operators, since they're capable of being more flexible than the software will ever be. But the difficulty is nearly all of our computer technologies will be what I call joint cognitive systems, meaning that some of their management comes from humans and some comes from software. And the more and more autonomy you put into the system itself, the more and more difficult it becomes for the humans to guess what the drone will do in a new, unanticipated situation, and therefore the more difficult it will be for them to coordinate their activity with that of the software.
Because the human's command runs counter to what the programming for the device is.
For all practical purposes, yes.
Just in general, the idea of drones is, I mean, even the non-military types, I sit here still sort of amazed at the fact that the FAA is working on rules, and it seems like I'm reading about drones all the time now, people looking at other people's backyards and all that sort of thing.
Yeah, and the FAA rules and the addressing of this is sort of gives a very good example of what a mess it all is and how we deal with this in a piecemeal fashion. So even before the FAA was to bring out their rules, there were concerns about the threats to privacy of drones in public airspace. And yet the FAA is not exactly charged to oversee privacy concerns. So it went ahead and introduced its rules. One of its rules was that the use of any drone had to stay within a line of vision. They were immediately challenged by Amazon and other companies that want to make deliveries within, you know, deliveries of products directly, and they can't keep all of those drones in a line of sight. And they talked with Amazon and came up with a formula where Amazon would be free to test its delivery system, but they had to acknowledge immediately that we're going to have to revisit this issue and perhaps make changes down the line. At the same time, there was a lawsuit brought against the FAA which challenged the FAA to bring out or deal with privacy concerns. So that's something else that has to be dealt with. And if the FAA or the federal government doesn't deal with that, that will be dealt with by states and localities. So suddenly public officials in every state and every city have become aware that they're going to have to spend tens, if not hundreds of millions of dollars on privacy and surveillance concerns caused by drones in domestic airspace. So it's another, what shall we say, unmandated cost to the states and the municipalities.
Unfunded mandate, yeah. Wendell Wallach is our guest on the Jefferson Exchange. He's the leader of the Technology and Ethics Study Group at the Interdisciplinary Center for Bioethics at Yale University and the author of A Dangerous Master, How to Keep Technology from Slipping Beyond Our Control. Here's Paul in Grants Pass. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange.
Good morning. Fascinating topic. The thing that I see as the short-term outcome of all of this is a society that is akin to Kurt Vonnegut's Player Piano, if you've read that, where basically the vast majority of the population is doing nothing but entertaining itself, while the machines are doing all of the work. The larger issue to me has to do with the nature of the singularity that we seem to be going through. When I was first taught about the singularity, I assumed it was going to be a point as opposed to a process, and I think we're in mid-process in the singularity event that will reshape, if not eliminate, humanity.
When you say singularity event, you mean that tipping point where humanity ends up getting undone by its own stuff?
Correct, or replacing itself with new machinery. The most recent example of this, someone back east mapped the neural network in the brain of an earthworm and created a mechanical, electromechanical analog and downloaded that information into the electromechanical device, and the mechanical, electromechanical device behaved exactly as the earthworm did.
Really? Okay. Interesting
really.
Stuff.
That's where we're at. That's where we're headed. And the problem that we run into is that, in my view, many of the people who are operating the businesses and many of the people who are involved in this are not necessarily looking out for our best interests. The lethal systems that we're dealing with at the present time, one of the great debates has been, do we keep a human in the loop or not? Because the processing is so fast, the decision-making is so fast. Do we leave a human in the loop to make the go, no-go decision, or do we take the human completely out of it?
All right.
Well, this is a great question, and clearly coming from a listener who has a deep appreciation and understanding of some of the new technologies that are coming along. First off, let me just say that A Dangerous Master was written realizing that most people would not have this breadth of understanding. So it's very much an introduction to the emerging technologies. And even for those who have an understanding, it probably introduces them to areas of research, let's say like geoengineering or nanotechnology or so forth, that they know very little about. But now let me talk just a little bit about this question about whether we already are or are slipping into a singularity. The singularity has a lot of different meanings, and originally it meant a time when computers equaled and then quickly far succeeded human intelligence, and that they might or might not be friendly to the continuation of human existence. But now that term is being used much more broadly, and I think that was what was implied in the questioner's points. So if a singularity means a time when we have lost control of our destiny to technology, some would argue that we're on the inflection point where we're pretty close to that, or we've entered into that. And I sometimes see the self-driving cars as the metaphor for that. Technology is moving into the driver's seat as the primary determinant of human destiny. And my concern is we don't just walk into that space blindfolded, but we bring our intelligence to bear and look for those opportunities where we can reassert our control over the trajectory of emerging technologies. The earlier in the development of a technology that we assert that control, better is our opportunity to radically shift the trajectory, or if not, or even just nudge the trajectory in a way in which the destination becomes much different than where we might go otherwise. And that's one of the points I'm really trying to emphasize. But there has been a concern throughout the history of technology, and you see it particularly in the United States, that it's very hard to know what the societal impact of a technology is before it becomes fully entrenched. And once it's entrenched, it's very hard to redirect its course. And I and others sort of reject the simple either-or option, and we think that somewhere fairly early on, it starts to become evident what will be the societal impact of a technology when there are still opportunities to change its course.
But what gets in the way? Is it science or is it money? It seems like in a system where people can make fantastic piles of money off of new technologies, they're not about to want to stop and say, okay, we'll stop.
Well, it's a little bit of both. It's scientists who are just intent on achieving their goals and have no interest in altering those goals at all. That's a challenge right now for folks in artificial intelligence as to whether the dangers they perceive can fully be mitigated, can fully be controlled, and if not, can they fully achieve their goals? On the other hand, I agree with you that perhaps making money sometimes takes precedence over the societal impact of the way we're making money, and particularly in a society that puts so much emphasis on productivity, sometimes with the illusion that increased productivity will create more jobs, but it doesn't seem to be doing that.
Well, and there's a whole chapter in here on jobs and computerization. I mean, which begs a question, which is if we're talking about technology that lets us live longer, and technology that should make our jobs easier, why are so many people un or underemployed while the working people seem to work really, really hard?
Well, I'm among those who believe that. What shall we say? What's called technological unemployment, or at least the downward pressure on job creation and wage development, has already occurred. We're in the fourth decade of stagnation in the real wages for goods-producing workers, and there's what's sometimes called a separation, a gap between productivity and job creation, where those two move together. For many, many decades, suddenly they are no longer moving together. Productivity is jumping forward, but job creation at best is only moving forward at a snail's pace. And this has a lot to do with many different factors, but perhaps one of the most important is the roboticization of jobs. In fact, according to one analysis, 47% of jobs in the United States could be computerized. And if only 1 or 2% of those are computerized each year, that will put further pressure on job creation and wage growth.
Ah, there's where the creep goes on. The book is called A Dangerous Master, How to Keep Technology from Slipping Beyond Our Control. Wendell Wallach wrote it. He's our guest on the Jefferson Exchange. We've got some phone calls waiting. We'll come back and talk with our guest and take your phone calls and emails when we return to the Jefferson Exchange in a minute 20. Final segment on today's Jefferson Exchange. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. Our guest today is Wendell Wallach from the Technology and Ethics Study Group, or T&E, at the Interdisciplinary Center for Bioethics at Yale University. He is always looking into ways in which technology and the human condition intertwine, and he's written a book about it called A Dangerous Master, How to Keep Technology from Slipping Beyond Our Control. Not quite to the level of the Terminator series of movies, for example, but you know, looking at the possibilities that those days could lie ahead of us. Join us on the Jefferson Exchange at 800-838-3760, anywhere in the listening area, by email jx@jeffnet.org. Now, lest we scare people into thinking that there are situations where, oh my God, we're giving things over to the computers, Paul cited some rather scary examples in his phone call, but there are some real-world examples of things like the flash crash. Can you remind us what that was, Wendell?
Sure. The flash crash was a day, actually over just a few hours, when values declined precipitously on the New York Stock Exchange and on NASDAQ, and then turned around almost as quickly and regained most of their losses.
And that was computer trading. There was no human intervention in the trades being made?
That was computer trading. There is a recent analysis that suggests it might have been set in motion by somebody trying to manipulate the markets, but the markets ostensibly should not be fully manipulated by the actions of one person. I mean, this was much broader than that.
So when we were talking about the technological singularity a few moments ago about the idea of reaching a point where what we've created becomes smarter than us, you also write about something called the Collingridge Dilemma in that same chapter. What is that?
So the Collingridge Dilemma was what I alluded to a little bit in the previous segment. The Collingridge Dilemma states that that it would be easiest to change a technology very early in its development, but you have really little idea of how it's going to develop or whether your actions will cause unintended consequences or even speak directly to the problems of a technology. And unfortunately, by the time you know that, the technology becomes so dramatically entrenched that it cannot be altered. And so this dilemma has haunted people in technology development for a few decades now. Many of us are trying to suggest that, no, there is an inflection point between those two, and we still have opportunities to change the course of a technology. Think of that inflection point as a window of opportunity. Sometimes it opens and closes very quickly. Sometimes it stays open for years. But the real difficulty is if we're so caught up in reacting to new challenges, we may never get to even recognize that inflection point is there.
I'm glad you mentioned scientists a little more extensively when I was going off for a second time about how, when people make money, they don't care about, you know, what gets hurt. Because the fact is that sometimes scientists do things that they think are really great because they think they're helping humanity. And the example of golden rice is in here. Take us down that alley.
So golden rice is the introduction of a vitamin into rice that will save a lot of blindness that is occurring in Asia. And the difficulty here was that the scientists decided this was a good idea. They created golden rice, and they started testing it in various countries. And there was an uprising, I believe it was in the Philippines now, to destroy one of these test beds. And the idea was that scientists should not necessarily be making decisions as what is good or not good for us, and the populace was never consulted. They were never consulted as to whether the scientific solution was the correct solution or the solution they most wanted to embrace. It was just a decision made without any interaction with the communities who would be affected at all. most of us, when we hear this story, think that the communities were a little dumb and blind. But I think when you think more broadly about new grains and the way in which the three companies that control most grain production are trying to take over control of what happens in communities throughout the world, you can understand that there's some resistance to just allowing those companies make decisions for you. In this case, it was not one of those companies. It was a consortium of people who really had good intent. They were making sure that the grain would be available freely so it wouldn't profit anyone. But it was implemented in a way that was insensitive.
Oh, so even the best of intentions can go awry if the approach is not one that people feel like they have some stake in or some piece of.
And that's an awful lot of what I think I'm trying to get at, both that people need to be consulted, but also we need to have more people educated about what the challenges are so that they will weigh in. It's not always the scientists or the policymakers best able to make those decisions. And at the very least, the scientists and the policymakers need input from the public to know better what to attend to. There's always NGOs and scholars trying to raise red flags, but that doesn't necessarily get any attention either, and sometimes even those parties are overly committed to their own goals that they don't really think more broadly about what the advantages and disadvantages, so they don't weigh off the trade-offs between those two when giving their recommendations. That kind of charge has been laid at the foot of some environmentalists recently that in their zeal to protect the environment, they sometimes don't look at what the trade-offs are, sometimes why the technologies, even with their dangers, may be worth implementing. That's one of the arguments, for example, that comes up when you talk about fracking.
All right. Much more to talk about there. We've got a few minutes left. Let's go to Jamie in Medford. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange with Wendell Wallach, the author of A Dangerous Master.
Good morning, Jeffrey.
Howdy.
Good morning, Wendell. First of all, a comment as regards to, I believe there was something mentioned earlier about atomic weaponry. There was a notion at the time that they were just starting to start the testing of that device that it might have actually have set the atmosphere on fire and completely incinerated all life on the planet. But they went ahead with it anyway because they felt it was necessary. It was a means to an end to stop a very tragic war that was going on. And Wendell, here's something I want to bring up that's been going on a long time, and it may not have anything to do with autonomy or anything like that, but it's called, well, in the words of The Graduate in the movie, the word is plastics. Plastics have been around. It's supposedly meant to be a godsend, a better living through chemistry, and now it's starting to bite us in the butt, and I just wanted to know what your thoughts were about that, and Jeffrey, I'll take his comments off the air if I could.
All right. Thanks for the line from The Graduate there, Jamie.
Well, plastics, first of all, are a great example of something where we universally use them, but we don't look at the societal impact. And the societal impact, I believe, should be built right into the cost of the technology. I've gone back and forth to India many times in my life, and I traveled through these beautiful regions that were pristine when I first went there. Now they have plastic bottles and plastic bags, you know, strewn everywhere. It's really a tragic phenomena. But I think we get into this concern with so many technologies that somehow we have divorced what the real cost of the technology is from the actual sale of the technology for those who are producing these new goods and services. So that is a real concern. The example you gave of the possibility that the first atomic bomb could actually ignite the atmosphere, that example I actually talk about, and I think page 5 of A Dangerous Master, after introducing the example with the Large Hadron Collider, and I basically point that out as another example of where physics, or at least one theory, suggested that it could ignite the atmosphere. And though that was brought up and determinations were made that it wouldn't happen, one of the scientists, Enrico Fermi, who had a rather macabre sense of humor, was taking bets as to whether it would ignite the atmosphere, and if so, would it destroy the whole planet or just New Mexico, where, of course, all the people he was taking bets with were at that time.
Wow. Did many take him up on the bet?
That I've never seen in any of the histories of this. I've seen the event related, but I have no idea whether anybody actually took him up.
I never knew Fermi had that kind of a sense of humor. Gene in Winston is on the line. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange with Wendell Wallach.
Hello?
Yes, go ahead.
Yes. Would you discuss the impact or role of AI in globalization and integrating all the world's governments and rules and all of that stuff and all the bureaucracy? Yeah, the interaction of bureaucracy and AI.
All right. Artificial intelligence, AI, and globalization. Interesting connection. Thanks for that, Gene. Wendell, thoughts?
Well, the real question is whether it is integrating. It's certainly creating those opportunities. Everybody gets to have information from each other, and that might afford the opportunity for some harmonization between countries. It certainly opens the door to make that much easier, but that doesn't mean it's always occurring because each country has its own goals. So in some cases, countries will pursue a technology even if it radically violates the sensibilities of another country. So this becomes a second problem. Given the productivity gains we get from being the first into an industry, do we want to take on restraints that other countries might not take on? And even if there is broad agreement that a technology might be dangerous, how do we harmonize the policies between the different countries? In some cases, there is a universal acknowledgement that there might be a danger. So that's happening in what's called geoengineering. Geoengineering is the use of technological means to mitigate the effects of global climate change. And there has been some recognition that some of the strategies in geoengineering, like seeding the atmosphere with sulfate particles, could reflect some of the sunlight away and lower the impact, or at least how much temperature goes up each year. But if we start allowing countries to tinker with climate in this way, well, who knows, perhaps China might implement a policy that would direct more of the monsoons to them, creating droughts in Bangladesh and India.
That's a little scary. And you mentioned in the book at least one freelance attempt to do some geoengineering in the ocean.
There was this attempt where chemicals were poured in the hydro region of the Pacific, and that was to increase the algae and therefore the food available for various fishing concerns. So on one level, it might look okay, but the very idea that somebody could do this and there was no restraint, doesn't seem that they broke any law, suddenly alerted governments around the world that we need some standards in place for what kinds of geoengineering is acceptable and what isn't.
Another call here from Michael in Mendocino. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange with Wendell Wallach.
Well, good morning. Just a brief question. It seems like a problem that we have here on the overuse of misguided technology is based much on, I think you pointed out obliquely, about scarcity economics. With our wonderful technology today, it literally has made scarcity obsolete. The question is, can we change humanity's psychological viewpoint of scarcity? Can we stand to live in prosperity? And I'm talking about Galbraith, David Reisman, Bazelon, and other speakers mm-hmm. from half a century ago are pointing this out, and I'd like to hear your view
All right.
on that. Thank you.
Thank you, Michael.
Well, that's really difficult because scarcity psychology serves the interests of many, and even while it doesn't serve the interest of others. And even though we call it scarcity psychology, that doesn't mean there isn't scarcity for some people. So, for example, in the United States, we have booming productivity, and yet 50% of citizens still live very much on the edge. There was a survey a few years back that asked people how they would meet a $2,000 crisis. We're talking, you know, a car breakdown, maybe braces for their kids, or a new furnace in the home. Fully 27% of people said they could not meet that crisis, and roughly, I think it was another 22% said they could only do so by taking out a loan or by some other difficult means for them. So we're now living in a society, a rich society, in which half the citizens feel like they live on the edge. Well, many of us, and I include myself, don't have these crises at all. A $2,000 crisis is pulling out a credit card that I'll pay off from assets a few weeks later. So we're caught in this trap between scarcity still being experienced by many at the same time as we have a productive system that could eliminate scarcity, but certainly not if nearly all the capital growth goes to a small percentage of the population, which is exactly what's happening right now.
So inequality sharpens the concerns of on a lot of levels, and then sharpens the effect of discussions about technology, it sounds like.
Exactly, and it's even getting exacerbated by the fact that the high-tech technologies we have today need very few workers to create tremendous profit.
Another source of great anxiety for working classes around the world. The Dangerous Master, How to Keep Technology from Slipping Beyond Our Control, is the book. Wendell Wallach wrote it and joined us today in the exchange. Wendell, great conversation. Thank you so much.
Thank you ever so much for having me, Jeffrey.